Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
1 year ago today, President Obama signed the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, $787 billion for economic stimulus projects like tax cuts, education, unemployment benefits, and infrastructure improvements. We've actually used about $270 billion so far, so was it money well spent?
I think Ironworking is experiencing a rough time right now. You know, I think there's a lot of fear, and maybe the stimulus money, if it does kick in, maybe they can go ahead with these jobs.
Out on the main streets of America, the story of the stimulus seems to be inconclusive.
Same sad story, that's a fact. One step up and two steps back.
Making slow progress, standing in place, inching backwards. There's no GPS to track the stimulus money. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 17th. I'm Celeste Headlee, and I'm joined this week by Todd Zwillick, who is filling in for John Hockenberry.
Morning, Celeste. Let's get right to some of the top stories we're following this morning. We're learning this morning that delegations representing the Taliban and the Afghan government held face-to-face talks in the Maldives Islands at the end of January. A spokesman for the Maldives government says the delegations, each consisting of 11 members, were trying to find a peaceful solution to the war in Afghanistan. Reportedly, there was no U.S. delegation present at the talks. More now on the one-year anniversary of Barack Obama's President Obama stimulus package. This morning, the White House is out with a new report saying the $787 billion plan has been on target and effective. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says it's not surprising the stimulus plan doesn't do very well in the polls.
You've just lost your job. Your wife just lost their job. You're having trouble figuring out how you're going to pay for your kids' college. And somebody says, how's the Recovery Act working?
Well, let's ask someone how it's working. Charlie Dilbert is a highway worker, and he joins us from Cincinnati. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
Charlie, we spoke to you and Pete Herman, that iron worker from New York, just a few months ago. You both told us different stories about the stimulus, but Pete said the stimulus is a bust. What grade do you give the stimulus act?
I give it about a 7 right now.
A 7 out of 10?
Yes.
And you got a job from the stimulus act?
Yes, I have.
And you're still employed?
Well, right now I'm unemployed. I've got some training I got to do at the end of the month here for a company that I was working for before. And also, I should be going back probably, I'm hoping, the end of March or the mid part of April.
Pretty soon. Charlie, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Toyota's troubled winter is continuing. This morning, we're learning the automaker is considering a recall of the Corolla because of possible power steering problems. The Corolla is the world's best-selling car. Toyota's president said all future Toyota models will have a brake override system.
And while Afghan government and Taliban delegations may be talking peace, the fighting continues in Marja.
He needs tracers! Tracers!
NATO says 4 service members have been killed in the 5-day assault so far. For the first time in this fight, though, U.S. troops are firing non-lethal smoke rounds to disperse fighters in an effort to save civilian lives. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Rod Nordland, correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, in Kabul. He told us U.S. soldiers are focused on avoiding civilian casualties.
Right down to the platoon level, the soldiers really have taken on board this message that, you know, civilian casualties are a dumb idea in this kind of war.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, the number of American troops has dropped below 100,000 for the first time since that war began. And new economic numbers out this last hour. The Commerce Department says construction of new homes and apartments rose 2.8% last month. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,268, the S&P at 1,094, and the NASDAQ opens at 2214. We're covering the Winter Olympics all this week, and today we're going to be talking about how ice skating figure skaters choose what to wear.
we're covering this. The stimulus bill was signed into law a year ago. We're covering it today with correspondent Andrea Bernstein. But we also want to know if the stimulus is having an effect in your neighborhood. 8778-MY-TAKE. Post your responses to thetakeaway.org. More on stimulus coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
1 year ago today, this was the headline.
The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that I will sign today, a plan that meets the principles I laid out in January, is the most sweeping economic recovery package in our history.
That is President Barack Obama as he signed the stimulus bill. In the last 12 months, the federal government has gotten $453 billion out the door in spending and in tax cuts. The money's been used to keep teachers at work, build bridges over rivers, extend unemployment benefits, and thousands of other government efforts to save the economy, like road building. What do we know about how well it's worked? We're asking what you think and what you're seeing in your own neighborhood at 8778-MY-TAKE.
My name is Frances Anthes, and I work at a community health center. We've really seen the effect of this economic stimulus. It's allowed us to expand in some cases, or at least to hire new staff. We're seeing more people than ever because we provide high-quality care to a lot of people who don't have health insurance or who have been laid off.
We're hoping to get your reports of what you're seeing in your own community in the stimulus. Leave us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm joined now by Andrea Bernstein. She covers transportation issues, the stimulus bill, infrastructure, which means you get to read a lot of reports, right, Andrea?
Reports are me.
So the newest report we have tells us how the stimulus money has been spent.
That's right. Vice President Biden, who's been sort of put in charge of the implementation of the Recovery Act by the president, put out a report last night. And in the report, he says that they have $453 billion out the door and that they have created or saved 2 million jobs. Now, there's a really interesting line that you don't often find in a report like this. It says, notwithstanding this progress, the nature of the Recovery Act remains misunderstood by many and misconstrued by others. Critics have suggested the entire $787 billion is being spent on earmarked programs. In fact, he says, it's mostly gone to tax relief and then direct aid to states and individuals, which have basically prevented both state budgets and individual budgets from cratering.
Right, and a lot of that went to help the state budgets refill their unemployment coffers, right, to keep paying unemployment,
right,
benefits.
I mean, in poll after poll, Americans really don't like the stimulus because they think of it as something that's building a road for somebody else. And they don't connect that everybody got a tax cut, or 95% of Americans got a tax cut, that many people who are unemployed have gotten their insurance benefits extended, have gotten unemployment insurance extended. And these things are very, very hidden. So the administration finds itself sort of digging out of a public relations hole saying, look, it's really been going well. See?
Well, we are joined again by Charlie Dilbert, a highway worker from Cincinnati, Ohio. Charlie, we talked to you on October 30th. Are these things hidden for you? I mean, you yourself are getting a job out of the stimulus, but what about the people around you?
I see there's some people things are starting to work. I was talking to a fellow the other day, and he was telling me that he works for the railroad, and they move a lot of commerce and a lot of things, and he's telling me that traffic is up. They're hauling steel, they're hauling a lot more goods and stuff. So if that's that's part of it too, that means that there's people that are working, the people that are starting to benefit from this, just not only construction workers and other people, that it's coming. And I think a lot of people need to be real patient. They're jumping the gun. Americans like to have everything real fast,
Well, you're one of those Americans, Charlie. And I'm not saying that you want to have things fast, but you are an American, and you can maybe emphasize, as Press Secretary Robert Gibbs did, with people who are still unemployed and therefore feel like the stimulus plan isn't working because they don't have a job.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, the government's putting this money out there to kickstart the economy. We need other industries and other businesses to start, saying, okay, now we've sat on the sidelines long enough and we've watched everything. Now we need to start participating. And I truly think that's coming. I mean, private sector is going to be part of the government's plan to, you know, push this thing along too. It's just not all about the government. It can't. I don't believe it can be.
Well, Andrew, part of the PR problem for the stimulus bill has been these changing numbers, all these different reports coming out saying that we don't actually know how many jobs it's been created. Some of these numbers are wrong. What makes this so difficult?
Well, there have definitely been growing pains. I mean, you know, one of the things that happened with the Recovery Act, coming as it did on the heels of the bank bailout, was that there was this huge pledge, we're going to be transparent, we're going to say everything that we're doing, unlike the bank bailout, which has pretty much zero transparency. As a result of that, people are trying to fill out these forms, and some people understand it, and some people ended up putting up all the jobs in their companies, not the ones that were created by the Recovery Act. And these things were very easy to spot, and there were many news stories about it, and we did some of them. But the White House is saying, you know, you need to look at the sort of the created or saved picture. And, you know, the thing that Charlie was saying about Americans like to have everything come real fast is a problem in the Recovery Act. Because if you look just at the projects, the concept of shovel ready, well, that is, okay, you're going to get it fast. It's ready to go. But what's ready to go? Not necessarily great things.
Well, shovel ready is kind of a problem because some of these projects require states to match what they're getting from the government, and states are broke.
Right, absolutely. And for example, in the state of Virginia right now, there's a tussle between the federal government and the state because the former Democratic governor didn't have a lot of projects in the pipeline to get going with the Recovery Act.
Andrea, it's also a problem of just plus minus, isn't it? I mean, the economy has, the bottom line is the economy has shed 3 million jobs or so since the recession started. Hard to make the case, well, we've created X number when you look at the bottom line, minus 3 million.
Right, exactly. And the White House really dug itself into the hole when at the beginning of its term, it said that the economy, the unemployment rate was going to top out way below what it is now. So now they're constantly explaining how they got that wrong, and they're sort of involved in that big debate rather than being able to point to what they see are the successes of this. And it's coming, as you know, and right as they're debating a new jobs bill, they're not saying the S word in Washington
right.
anymore because that has been sufficiently blackened. So
now
they're talking about
the S word.
A jobs bill.
Well, Charlie Dilbert from Cincinnati, Ohio, you described yourself as a poster boy for the stimulus. I guess we can't use stimulus, but for the stimulus bill. Are you the exception, do you think, where you are?
Not necessarily. Like I said, there's the union hall I belong to, there's still a lot of men and women that are still unemployed and stuff right now, and from what I'm hearing and talking to people, it's coming. There's work that's coming. Some of it's stimulus related, some of it's not, and it's going to take time. You know, I see a lot of people in our neighborhood. You know, they're working, they're going to work every day. I mean, it's you know, we're here shoveling snow and stuff, so it's kind of crazy here anyway. But I feel like things are, you know, they're going to start happening, and you know, it's coming. It's just, you know, it's going to take time.
Charlie Dilbert, highway worker from Cincinnati, Ohio, and Andrea Bernstein. She covers transportation and the stimulus bill for The Takeaway. And at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the headlines.
As we've been discussing, President Obama's stimulus plan is 1 year old today. The White House has a report on the status of the $787 billion package coming out this morning. Vice President Joe Biden tells CBS News he doesn't think the GOP win in Massachusetts was a wake-up call for Democrats alone.
I think it was to everybody in public life. And it was, hey, guys, get your act together, get something going.
Now, the vice president called the unrelenting gridlock in Congress the worst he's seen in more than three decades. In auto news, the Department of Transportation has asked Toyota to hand over all documents related to their massive recalls. This morning, Nicole Nason of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration tells CBS News that Washington is taking the automaker's problems very seriously.
What I think is very significant is that the government has issued this letter sending a very strong message to Toyota saying, we want to know what you knew and when you knew it.
Also this morning, Toyota's president says he will not make the trip to the United States for congressional hearings on vehicle safety issues.
In Afghanistan, NATO soldiers continue their offensive in the city of Marja today. One Afghan official says Taliban fighters are using women and children as human shields. And finally, at home, Walgreens is set to buy rival drugstore chain Duane Reade in a deal valued at more than $1 billion. That includes debt. We're going to have more information on that as it becomes available. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, for the first time, airport screeners are going to start roving through the airports, taking chemical swabs from passengers and their bags to check for explosives. We're going to talk more about that policy and how it works in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We have a takeout straight from Egypt today. For years, people wondered what had killed 19-year-old boy king Tutankhamun. Many people suspected it was foul play, probably because that's the most interesting option. But it turns out it was much less sinister, although we still don't have all the questions answered. New research shows he likely died from a severe bout of malaria combined with a degenerative bone condition. We have with us on the show Egypt's top archaeologist and secretary general of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, Dr. Zahi Hawass. He pieced together the clues leading up to what we now know as the cause of King Tut's death. He joins us now. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So tell me about the new technologies that were able to get you finally an answer on the cause of King Tut's death.
You know what? Using DNA and PET scan machine to reveal the mystery of King Tut, before I will tell you about his death, I have to tell you that DNA revealed to us many important discoveries. For example, we found the mummy of Akhenaten, the first one who believed in one god, and he's the father of King Tut. We found the mother of Akhenaten, Queen Ti, and we found the mummy of the mother of King Tut. We don't know her name, but she is the daughter of Amenhotep III. I mean that Akhenaten, the father of King Tut, married his whole sister. But the amazing mystery is how we revealed the secrets about his death. You know, in 2005, when I did examine the mummy with CAT scan machine, I found out that he had an accident a few hours before he died. But now we found out he had a severe malaria. And the second, he was not a normal boy. He was actually suffered a flat foot in his right leg, and also his toe on the left foot has deformatives and was weak bones, and he was limping. And this is why He was using sticks to walk. We found Howard Carter found 130 sticks in his tomb. It shows that the man using the sticks to walk.
Like crutches, he was using crutches.
Severe malaria.
Yeah, and you found the malarial parasite in his blood, along with signs, like you said, of bone disease. And King Tut may have been walking with crutches throughout his life. It's amazing the things that they can discover now with DNA using obviously centuries old blood. That is Dr. Zahi Hawass, the face of archaeology in Egypt. He's also the Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities.
All right, let's go from the science of ancient tombs in Egypt to the science of modern airports in the United States. Airport screeners for the first time will begin walking through airports taking chemical swabs from passengers and their bags to check for explosives. That's according to the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration. So is this a good idea? Joining us is Colonel Randall Larson. He's the founding director of the Institute for Homeland Security at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Colonel Larson, swabbing for explosives in the airport, how does this work?
Well, that's something we've been actually doing for a very long time. Back in 1996, I was the commander of the fleet of VIP airplanes at Andrews Air Force Base, Air Force One, Air Force Two, and all that. We were using that technology way back then, the swabs. And that technique has been used by TSA for quite a while. I think one of the things they're talking about now is the fact that they use more behavioral detection officers. These are people who, in plain clothes, you don't know who they are, they're walking around airports in the United States, and they're looking for behaviors. I think sometimes we rely too much on technology, whether it's these new millimeter wave scanners that can look under your clothing, what some people call the virtual strip search. very expensive machines that are not that difficult to defeat. But we found great success in this behavioral detection. It's one of the things that's called the SPOT program, screening passengers by observational techniques. And we haven't stopped any terrorists yet, but you know, they found a lot of criminals, you know, drug runners, people taking money, people having the wrong passports. There's certain behaviors you generate.
Okay, but in this case, what they're doing, though, if I have it right, I think I've seen these machines before. They take a little sort of a gauze pad and they feel around on your bag and then they stick it in an analyzer. And if you've got bomb residue on your bag, it beeps, right?
Yeah, and like I said, that's not a new technology.
Right.
And TSA's been doing that even before 9/11. You don't see that quite so much anymore now because, I mean, I guess it would really catch the stupid terrorist.
But this also, the stupid terrorist, right.
I mean, you know, if I'm going to carry a bomb on an airplane, I'm going to have someone else pack it. I'm never going to touch the bomb-making material.
Okay, well, Colonel, that's my question because this ostensibly, if they had it in the airport in Amsterdam, obviously not in the United States, this would have caught Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, the notorious underwear bomber, right? If they would have had that swab near him, it probably would have caught him. So is this just another example of American reactivity in security?
Well, you know, I don't know if he loaded the material into his underwear or not. I don't have the details on that. Like I said, it would catch the really stupid bomber. And But it's something we've been doing for a long time. I mean, that's nothing new. We were doing that in commercial airports prior to 9/11. You saw a lot of it immediately after 9/11. It was just expanded more. But frankly, I fly about once a week, and I haven't – well, I'll take that back. I did see one since Christmas, but only in one airport, and I've probably flown close to 10 times since Christmas. So it's nothing new. It's out there. The behavioral techniques is a much more promising – I think it's a much better return on our investment. Okay,
well, let me ask you finally then, Colonel Larson, if behavioral techniques are superior – you're talking about the stupid bomber. Why can't a smart bomber or a good actor keep calm and get around behavioral forensics?
Very good question. The answer is this is their first mission they're on.
And they get nervous. All right. Colonel Randall Larson, founding director of the Institute for Homeland Security at the University of Pittsburgh, walking us through some, well, maybe not such new technology of swabbing your bags randomly for explosive residue, but new to the TSA because they're going to be using it preemptively throughout U.S. airports. Coming up, we talk about the first new nuclear plant to be built in the United States for 3 decades and what those plants mean for the local communities where they're being built. That's in a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 31 minutes after the hour. We're learning this morning that delegations representing the Taliban and the Afghan government held face-to-face talks in the Maldives Islands at the end of January. A spokesman for the Maldives government says the delegations, each consisting of 11 members, were trying to find a peaceful solution to the war in Afghanistan. There was reportedly no U.S. delegation present at those talks. Meanwhile, Toyota's troubles continue this morning with no end in sight. The automaker is considering a recall of the Corolla because of possible power steering problems. The Corolla is the world's top-selling car. Toyota's president also says all future models will have a brake override system and that the company will hire new quality control officers to test every vehicle.
It's the one-year anniversary of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or as you probably know it, President Obama's stimulus bill. This morning, the White House is releasing a new report saying the $787 billion plan has been effective. But with unemployment hovering around 10%, there are many people who think the White House and Congress don't get what Americans are going through. Vice President Joe Biden tells CBS News there's enough blame to go around for that.
Washington right now is broken. I don't ever recall a time in my career where to get anything done, you needed a supermajority, 60 out of 100 senators.
Also today, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is expecting to announce $1.5 billion for major transportation projects. And if you're worried about a tax audit, maybe you should be. Nearly 1.5 million Americans were audited last year. That's the most in a decade. Even more audits are expected as the Obama administration plans to spend over $8 billion on tax enforcement. Markets are open now. The Dow's up about 13, the S&P up about 7, and the NASDAQ up about 3. Those are some of the news stories you're following this morning.
We are announcing roughly $8 billion in loan guarantees to break ground on the first new nuclear plant in our country in 3 decades.
Radioactivity.
President Obama spoke to a crowd of union officials yesterday and announced that he has approved an $8.3 billion loan to help have two nuclear reactors built in Burke County, Georgia. We should point out that Kraftwerk was not standing behind him singing that. That was a little bit of our own artistic license there with the president. This is part, however, of President Obama's clean energy campaign to help create jobs and become energy self-sufficient. Now, of course, nuclear energy cannot be mentioned without some controversy, in fact, a lot of controversy. So is this announcement the start of a new wave of nuclear energy in the United States? We want to put that very question to our guest, Gary Golden. He's a futurist and blogger for the Energy Roadmap. Gary's in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nuclear power, I grew up in the shadow of Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. Nuclear power making a comeback makes this person nervous. I remember those days. Are we looking at a new wave of nuclear power in America?
So nuclear energy has not stopped being controversial. And while this is a significant shift in policy, the economics of nuclear power generation remain very uncertain.
Very uncertain. So we can put $8.3 billion up in loan guarantees, but it doesn't prevent necessarily rate hikes or tax hikes or cost overruns in building a plant. We don't know where that's going.
Yeah. So, you know, people think this is a government-backed loan, but really it's the private sector that builds nuclear power plants.
The private sector built
the private sector.
So why is the president making an announcement of 8.3? What does he have to do?
Well, what prevents nuclear power plants from being built are permits and financing. And what the loans do is they give investors confidence that the government is backing these new generations of nuclear power plants.
So, Gary, as we said, we haven't built a nuclear power plant in this country in 30 years. Where are we going to get the brain power and the engineers to build this plant? We're going to have to borrow them from France, where nuclear power is still really popular?
Yeah, so one of the challenges is the United States kind of missed a half of a generation of training the talent for advancing nuclear engineering. So the hope here is that this does spark construction of power plants, but the inspiration might be based off of new nuclear power generation techniques.
When you talk about whether this is questionable economics here, are you talking about whether or not nuclear energy is a viable, cost-effective power source?
So it depends on which side you stand on. So costs there's operating costs, there are capital costs, and there are different investment strategies associated with nuclear power generation. But utilities are highly regulated, and they generally find the investments to do what they need to do.
And our portfolio is about 15% nuclear nationwide already, right?
About 20%.
About 19%. 20%. Mm-hmm. All right, well, we have to talk about nuclear waste. Where I work in Washington, there's a constant debate about where to put the stuff. Some people want it in Nevada. Of course, it's not going there over Harry Reid's dead body, he says. And there are debates everywhere about how to transport this radioactive waste. Is there anything new in nuclear waste that's going to change the conversation about whether we should just bury the stuff?
Yeah, so it's important to note that we are really in very early days with our understanding of nuclear science and engineering. And the idea of just simply putting this nuclear waste in a place is kind of dated. And what the Department of Energy and entrepreneurs are looking to do is to develop ways of using this nuclear energy waste as a fuel source that they can then reuse these bundles from traditional power plants for new forms of nuclear power
generation.
Okay,
but we're not quite there yet, and I want to turn to somebody who's probably been thinking about this, Mayor George DeLoach of Waynesboro, Georgia, where these plants are going to be built. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning.
I know that you're probably excited about the jobs, but let me ask you about the waste first. Are you ready to have the fistfights over transporting this stuff to through the counties next to you or the states next to you? They're not going to want to see your waste going through their territory.
Well, we really haven't given that much thought. You know, we're right next to SRS, which is a nuclear facility in South Carolina, and they have a disposal, I think, over in Barnwell, South Carolina, where they keep low-grade waste now. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping, you know, the president will find a place to keep our nation's nuclear waste. But now we're just tickled to death about the 3,000 to 4,000 jobs that it's going to provide for our area.
Well, I want to ask you about that. 3,000 to 4,000 jobs, that's in construction, right? What
yes.
about in the long term?
Yes, that's construction. The permanent, I think, the permanent number would be around 850 to operate the Unit 3 and 4. We already have Unit 1 and 2 in operation, and there's about 800 to 900 people operating that in the county. And so anytime you add 800 to 900 more permanent residents, you know, that really has a economic effect on your on a small community.
Now, Mayor, amid the red, white, and blue bunting and the White House security advance and all the pageantry, do you have concerns in your community about how this is going to be paid for, potential rate hikes on existing customers, or tax hikes at some point? Is there any concern about that?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be about a 9% increase in the residential rates.
Well, that's a lot, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't think so, okay. Really. When you see what we're paying for gasoline now and oil, I don't think it's that, you know, that expensive, no.
All right.
We want to get dependent, you know, away from foreign oil, and this is, I think, the best way to generate electricity is by nuclear power.
Mayor Gary Deloach of Waynesboro, Georgia, where they're building nuclear power plants. Gary Golden, you're shaking your head. Quickly, why?
Well, I think it's important to note that the transportation fuels or gasoline transportation fuels are not in competition with natural gas and coal and nuclear to generate electricity.
So that's utilities versus transportation, but all part of the overall energy portfolio. Well, say one thing for nuclear, it's not a fossil fuel. The president is promoting nuclear power. Gary Golden, futurist and blogger, thanks for joining us. Coming up, our Winter Olympics coverage continues with how figure skaters get covered themselves, or sometimes lack of coverage. We're talking about their clothing. We're talking about their fashion, and we're talking about the fashion of ice skating with fashion designer and figure skating outfit designer Project Runway contestant Nick Varios. He's joining us later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm Todd Zwillick.
It's like being married to her, you know? Yes, honey, no, honey, whatever it is you want is fine with me. And it's good. It's worked. Works in real life, too.
He's not talking about his girlfriend. He's talking about Sadie, the dog he handles. She's the Scottish Terrier who took home Best in Show at the Westminster Dog Show. Joining us is Sarah Montague, a reporter for WNYC Radio in New York. She's been covering the dog show for a decade. Welcome, Sadie. I want to ask you about Sadie. She won, but I first want to give a say to Judge Elliot Weiss, who knows why Sadie won Best in Show.
She thinks very highly of herself, and she looked at me and as if to say, you know, enough already. You know I'm special. Just go give me the ribbon. I mean, it was that kind of look, which is typical Scottish Terrier, and that's the breed character you want.
Sarah Montague, when you looked at Sadie, did you get that very impression?
I absolutely did. In fact, the clip you just played at the top of the moment was from a conversation I had with Gabriel on Sunday at a charity brunch, and I said, Scotties are incredibly opinionated and self-willed. How did you get her to buy into this? And he said, basically, it's a marriage. I just do whatever she wants.
Whatever she wants. You know, to a lot of outside observers, the Westminster Dog Show appears to be sort of a canine four-legged fashion show. Is it something more than that to these judges and the handlers?
Much more than that, and I've always thought that was an inaccurate comparison, and that the more interesting one was more like the Olympics without the tasks. Most of what's being judged here has nothing to do with beauty per se. It has to do with dogs being bred for particular tasks and particular kinds of performance, particular ways of relating to us in our world, and looking at each one and saying, does that one come up to that standard? Is that the best Scottish Terrier I can see? Is that the best Chihuahua? Is that the best Mastiff?
But a working dog like a Border Collie who's bred for a task doesn't get to herd a bunch of sheep on the floor at the dog show, so how does he meet that standard?
The standards have to do with physical type. So what the judge is looking for, and if you watch this on television, you can see how they're kind of being patted down as if they're going through customs. They're looking for bone structure. They want to see that the shoulder is free and can move freely. They walk them back and forth. You watch them running them across the tarmac. That's to see if they move freely, if their hips work properly. They hold their heads to see if they can move properly. Depending on what the breed is, there's something that each judge is looking for, and he has or she has that picture in his mind.
Now,
I was going to say, yeah. Sarah, you got to see the photos of our takeaway dog show. Clearly, most of these are dogs that they're not pure breeds, many of them, but they're also not bred to be show dogs. The Benny was the winner of the takeaway dog show, and here's a clip from the owner.
Up until recently, though, he was a little overweight. Actually, the vet had him listed as obese, as a Chihuahua. He was up to almost 9 pounds, and they're supposed to be about, I think, between 5 and 6 pounds.
Benny, probably not standing
a chance at the Westminster Dog Show.
That is true. And in fact, in some respects, the only way in which I would say the fashion show comparison makes any sense, is these dogs are beautifully kept and fit, and it does help, I think, owners of any kind of dog to remember this is an animal with a body. It's a mammal. Cherish it. Love it. Don't overcute it. Don't overfeed it. Don't let it lose its natural dignity by turning it into a possession or an accessory or something you're not paying attention to.
Sarah Montague, reporter with WNYC, who spent many years covering the Westminster Dog Show. While the Westminster Dog Show picked its best in show, Takeaway listeners picked their own too. Check out all the entrants at thetakeaway.org and see why Benny has come in best in show for Takeaway listeners 2010.
Oh, I think we could have come up with lots of dogs that were best in that show. They give their love to you. Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who's in for John Hockenberry this week. Coming up, we continue our coverage of the Winter Olympics with talking about how figure skaters keep covered or what they choose to uncover. The fashion of ice skating with fashion designer and former Project Runway contestant Nick Varios. That's in a few moments. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. It's the anniversary of President Obama's stimulus package. Today, the White House releases a report on how it fared. This morning, Vice President Joe Biden tells CBS he understands why Americans are angry with elected officials.
I think the American people's frustration is overflowing.
But the vice president says the stimulus bill was a success. He says Americans will see more job creation as the second wave of the plan kicks in.
Moving abroad now, a U.S. official is holding talks with the Syrian president in a sign the U.S. is improving relations with Damascus. Yesterday, the U.S. named a new ambassador to Syria five years after his predecessor was yanked to protest the murder of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Finally, in economic news, the Commerce Department says construction of new homes and apartments rose 2.8% last month. That's the highest level in 6 months. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
At the Olympics in Vancouver,
representing the United States of America, Evan Lysacek.
American figure skater Evan Lysacek took second place in last night's skating short program. Russian Evgeny Fushenko took the number one slot. Of course, who wins and loses isn't what sparks the most conversation or even controversy. It's what they're wearing when they skate on the ice. Men's figure skater Johnny Weir, a three-time United States national champion, had a solid skate, but he came in sixth. He's been making some last-minute alterations to his uniform, Johnny Weir has, but it's because of pressure from political activists. And during the European Championships last month, the Russians' pair team wore uniforms that were inspired by what was supposed to make them look like Aboriginals from Australia. The outfits were so unpopular, so controversial, they decided to change them for the Olympics. Joining us now is Nick Varios, a man very familiar with the power of fashion for the ice. Varios is a fashion designer, but his work has been featured on Project Runway, and he's regularly seen at red carpet events like the Oscars. So, Nick, did you see these Aboriginal costumes?
Yes. Yeah, well, the operative word is it's supposed to look like Aboriginal costumes. Yes, Dominina and Shabalin, the 2009 world champions from Russia, they did an original dance, an Aboriginal dance, and, you know, besides the controversy part of it, I just thought they were ugly, to be quite honest. You know, I understood what they were going for, I just don't think they achieved it. I do think that in terms of the controversy and whether or not it was culture-specific, I do think that they went a little too far by doing the darker skin-toned bodysuits, whereas, you know, they're very pale, and I think that they should have just stayed that color. But by doing that, it was almost like they were going into the quote-unquote blackface category, and that's
well, they
where
did
I
darken
the
their faces.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, exactly.
But you know, Nick Varios, this calls into question the place in which cultural sensitivity and fashion collide, and that's brought up by the other controversy going on, which is over the use of fur on Johnny Weir's costume.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Johnny Weir, always causing controversy, Johnny.
Right. He likes to do that. But in this particular case, there's a lot of people who are who have trouble with the fact that he's got fur on his mm-hmm. costume. It's got some activist groups up in arms. And again, this is
yes.
a problem. When you choose what to wear, you wouldn't think it's going to cause this kind of commotion where you're getting letters from nonprofit organizations. But it does.
But it does. It does. You know, I'm glad that people are paying attention to figure skating. you know, even though it is for controversial reasons, but I'm sure that the industry leaders and professionals would like to not have the controversy be about the costumes, but be more about the sport and the athleticism of it. But yeah, Johnny Weir always, you know, has to cause some controversy. I do think that he's reverted back to...
Yeah, he's changed
hopefully,
his mind.
Hopefully changed his mind, which is good. I think he just doesn't want to get pelted for
that
reason.
That would make it hard to skate.
Yes. It's one thing having red paint. It's another thing having red Swarovski crystals, darling.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you, who is someone who's very concerned with fashion, talk about focusing more on the athleticism, because there has also been a number of discussions about whether or not the ice skating uniforms are becoming too body bearing.
Oh, well, you know, I have to say that there was a bit of a controversy, especially with Evan Lysacek recently in one of his championships that he did. He wore a rather revealing Vera Wang. He's also gone with Vera Wang. She designed several costumes for him where most of his torso and six-pack ab was showing. and I guess that caused a bit of a controversy, and he never used it again. But, you know, I do think that it's interesting to show both the beauty of the athleticism, you know, and the art of figure skating as well. And it would be so boring to see them just in you know, bland jumpsuits. So I do think it's great to see... to see the sequins and to show a little bit of skin, as long as it's appropriate for the figure skating, you know, themselves, and as long as that they're being culturally sensitive.
What's the different challenges when you go to design a skating costume?
It's really close to what we call haute couture, which is high fashion. So it's a lot of, you know, doing gowns or dresses that are one of a kind, basically. And that's the same process that I think when I'm doing something for figure skating, because you really work one-on-one with the client. Especially with figure skating, you talk about the music and the person, and if it's appropriate for them, you know, something, a neckline that could be appropriate for somebody else might not necessarily be appropriate for them. But everything is one of a kind. The sequins are hand-sewn. The fabric is specially picked. You know, you don't just go to the 99-cent fabric store and buy some fabric and glue on some sequins and call it a day.
Well, I'm wondering if you had a specific skaters from the past that you look to as being particularly having particularly good taste in their costumes. I mean, you look back at Dorothy Hamill or maybe Oksana Bayul. Does anybody from the past have good taste on the ice?
Well, I don't know if Oksana Bayul would come under the good taste category, but definitely Michelle Kwan. But definitely Michelle Kwan is one of my favorites, especially because she's one of the first figure skaters who started working with actual fashion designers such as Vera Wang and, you know, collaborating and making one-of-a-kind costumes for her, not just for nationals, but as well as for the Olympic figure skating. So definitely her. I'm a big fan of Sasha Cohen. When I was on a show called Project Runway in season two, we had a wonderful challenge, which we had to design a figure skating costume for Sasha. So after I did that, it was like done and done, as they say.
Are we going to see any Nick Varios originals on the ice in Vancouver?
Well, we might. I can't really talk about it, but I did meet earlier or late last year. I did meet with Rachel Flatt, our reigning U.S. national champion, and she was a doll with a capital D, wonderful to talk to. And you know, of course, I profess my love of figure skating and love of designing costumes. And so we discussed a little here and there in terms of designing costumes. So you might see a Nick Varios original, but I have lawyers that are preventing me from saying anything.
Those lawyers are sticky that way. Okay, well, Nick Varios, will you come back after you've seen more of the fashions and let us know what you thought?
Oh, of course. I would love to. Thank you very much for having me.
Nick Varios is a fashion designer. His work has been featured on Project Runway. It's regularly seen at red carpet events like the Oscars. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, speaking of the best outfits and the worst outfits, we want to hear your thinking about who's having a good week and a bad week. We tally it up every Friday with our friends from The Week magazine. Give us your suggestions by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE and tune in to hear whether your picks match up with their picks. That's every Friday. And when it comes to good and bad, what's your take on the stimulus package? It was signed into law 1 year ago today, but is it working for you? Give us a report on how you see signs of the stimulus in your life, in your neighborhood, or not.
It's Kevin from Brooklyn. Without the stimulus package and the ARA subsidy for my health insurance, I would be broke because I'm unemployed, and the ARA subsidy really helps out immensely every month in a way that I don't think I've ever been helped out by the federal government before.
Hi, this is Alfredo from Plantation, Florida. I'm a custom handyman, and since the stimulus bill was signed, I have less work. There is no more disposable income. People are trying to do their jobs by themselves, end up calling me to try to fix it after the fact. Really, it's not working.
On our website, Camille posts, without the stimulus, I wouldn't have a job. As a recent college grad, my job outlook a year ago was dismal, but I found work in commercial property management in the D.C. area. Many of the tenants we serve are government contractors that signed new leases thanks to the stimulus.
And Dan writes, with the stimulus package, my research lab was able to buy equipment for a rat epilepsy monitoring unit and hire a postdoctoral fellow to oversee the project, which will allow us to screen new therapies for treating epilepsy.
And Linda posts onto our site, the stimulus plan has helped us afford to make our home more energy efficient. We live in an old house with serious insulation issues. We're using an interest-free government loan and taking advantage of a subsidy directly related to the larger federal stimulus package. It brings down the cost of what we could afford to pay and is going to go a long way toward reducing our huge energy bill.
Well, there's a lot of stories out there. Tell us your stimulus story at 8778-MY-TAKE. Of course, you can post it to the website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry this week.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.